Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Southern Fried True Crime covers cases that are not suitable for young listeners, and there may also be some explicit language used. Today's episode is especially grisly, and it involves sexual assault, so I would like to emphasize listener discretion. Our culture is fascinated with serial killers, to the point where now there is even some backlash for glamorizing monsters like Ted Bundy. But killers like Bundy often get the most attention because of the victims they choose. Edgar Allan Poe said it most eloquently, "The death of a beautiful woman is, unquestionably, the most poetical topic in the world." Humanity loves the destruction of beauty, and we devour these stories seemingly without shame. But Poe said that almost 50 years before Jack the Ripper started murdering unfortunates, the Victorian euphemism for prostitutes, in the impoverished Whitechapel district of London. Jack was operating almost 100 years before the term serial killer was coined, but he shares a methodology common to many serial killers who go undetected. They prey on the weak, the vulnerable, the truly unfortunate, the women society looks away from, rather than gaze at with unabashed obsession. Bobby Joe Long also fits this category. He claimed to have raped some 50 women and was convicted of murdering 10. He also joins a long list of serial killers who suffered head injuries in childhood. Welcome to episode 72, Serial Killer and Rapist, Bobby Joe Long. In Tampa, Florida, on November 3, 1984, at around 2 a.m., 17-year-old Lisa McVeigh was riding her bicycle home from work. She had worked the night shift at the Krispy Kreme Donuts on Florida Avenue. Lisa had volunteered to work a double shift because she did not want to go home. She had decided she was going to kill herself. Lisa was living with her grandmother and her grandmother's boyfriend, a man who physically, emotionally, and sexually abused her. Her mother was a drug addict, an alcoholic, who had little interest in raising her child, so Lisa was sent to her grandmother's several years earlier. As she biked home in the bleak pre-dawn hours, she thought of the suicide note she had already written. She told Crime Watch Daily that she just couldn't take it anymore. She cut through a parking lot to take a shortcut and said, quote, "The next thing I knew, I was just yanked off my bicycle, horrifically, just so forceful, it knocked the breath out of me." And she started screaming. Then she felt the barrel of a gun held to her left temple. A voice said, "Stop screaming or I'll blow your brains out." Lisa complied, and her assailant told her to close her eyes and keep them shut as he dragged her by her hair into his car. Then he told her to take all of her clothes off, and he tied her hands and wrists together with a handkerchief. He then forced Lisa to perform oral sex on him while they were in the car, and then he drove around for a while. They drove for about an hour before the man told her to get dressed, and then he blindfolded her and guided her up two flights of stairs. Once inside, Lisa was ordered to undress again, and for the next 26 hours, she endured repeated rapes. He also sodomized her orally and anally. But Lisa was already a survivor. She had decided while still in his car that she would not speak to him unless he spoke to her. She wanted to give him the sense that he had full control, so she stayed meek and compliant. Whenever the man let her use the restroom, Lisa would put her fingerprints everywhere she could. After the first few hellish hours, he put her in the shower and washed her hair and bathed her. As he dried her hair, he went from calling her bitch and being rough to calling her babe and becoming almost tender. But his mood would turn on a dime. Lisa played along as best she could. After one particularly violent rape, he said, quote, "Thank you. I don't know why I did this. You're such a nice girl." Then he said, "Revenge, I guess. I just broke up with my girl, and I'm tired of women walking all over me." Lisa stayed quiet, but he was surprisingly talkative now. He asked her if she had a boyfriend, and she said no. "Maybe I'll just keep you," he said. Lisa sensed that if she played along, she might survive this. She said, "You seem like a nice guy. I can take care of you. I'll be your girlfriend, and I won't tell anyone how we met." But she also told him she had a really sick father at home she was caring for and needed to get back to him. He untied her hands and put her in the bed with him as he fell asleep. Lisa laid there silently, drifting in and out of broken sleep through her terror. An alarm next to the bed went off, and Lisa saw it was 2:30 a.m. the next day. The man announced, "Time to get you out of here." He tied her hands back up and helped her dress, and then took her to the car. As he drove, Lisa could see under her blindfold and saw a couple of motels she recognized and realized they were close to the highway. He told her he needed to get money so he could stop for gas and asked if he could trust her. She said yes and didn't move. She could hear him pushing buttons on an ATM machine. They drove on for a while and then he stopped on the side of the road. He got her out of the car, still blindfolded. He asked her what she would tell her family. When Lisa said, "I don't know," he said, "Tell them some guy abducted you at gunpoint and borrowed you for a few hours." Lisa just nodded. He said, "It's because of your father that I'm going to let you live." And then he hugged her and kissed her on her forehead. And then he left. As he drove away, he said, "Take care. Hope your dad gets better." Lisa took her blindfold off, and the first thing she saw was a beautiful oak tree. She said she knew right then that her life was going to change forever. She had survived that horrific ordeal, and now she wanted to live. She saw the tree as representing a new branch of life. When she got home, she told her grandmother's boyfriend, who didn't believe her at first, but he finally called the police. At the station, she was able to describe her attacker very well. He was white. She also described his car as a two-door maroon vehicle with white seats and a brown dashboard that said Magnum in silver letters. Red carpet fibers were found on her clothes. Lisa didn't know it, but she had just given Hillsborough County detectives the exact make of a car they had been desperately searching for. Detectives weren't sure why this man let Lisa go. They just knew it was the break their team had been waiting for, and that Lisa McVeigh was very lucky to be alive. I'm going to pause now for a commercial break.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+ terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Robert Joseph Long was born on October 14, 1953, in West Virginia. His parents were Luella and Joe, and their son would always go by the name Bobby Joe. Bobby Joe's mother was only 17 when he was born. When he was 8 months old, she left his father. When Bobby Joe was 2, he and his mother moved to Miami. When he was 6 years old, Luella and Joe got back together and remarried. They moved to Huntington, West Virginia, and then Luella and Joe divorced again. They would remarry a third time. In fact, they were still married when their son was finally apprehended for his crimes. They showed a united front at his trial. But after the second divorce, Bobby Joe and Luella moved into a one-bedroom apartment. Bobby Joe would sleep in the same bed with his mother until he was about 12 years old. Luella worked as a car hop and barmaid during this time, and her son was ashamed of her job and the way she dressed. Kids at school taunted him, calling his mother Big Daddy's whore because the bar she worked at was called Big Daddy's. But Bobby Joe was teased for another reason. He had been born with an extra female chromosome. It's a genetic disorder called gynecomastia, or Klinefelter syndrome. It resulted in his glands producing abnormal amounts of estrogen, and Bobby Joe developed enlarged breasts during puberty. He had multiple surgeries to remove 6 pounds of excess tissue from his chest area. So he was definitely a target for bullies, not just for his mother's lifestyle, but his own strange disorder. So Luella and Bobby Joe moved around a lot. She had very little education and always took menial jobs to get by. And she was often ill with a chronic stomach problem that she said was related to stress. Later, according to his attorneys and a psychiatrist, Bobby Joe Long suffered numerous head injuries as a child. At age 4, he fell down a flight of stairs and was unconscious for 15 to 20 minutes. When he was 6, he fell out of a swing and was unconscious for a few minutes. It's unclear whether he was taken to a hospital during either of these incidents, or if this is all based on Luella's word. But at 7 years old, he was in a very serious accident. When he was walking home from school in the snow, he darted out in front of a car and was hit, and his face and head took the brunt of his injuries. The headlights of the car had hit him in the face, knocking his teeth loose. His injuries were most severe to his forehead, eyes, and jaw. He spent 9 days in the hospital, and afterwards, his mother said his teeth protruded straight out, and kids at school made fun of him. She also said that at age 9, he was thrown from a horse and knocked unconscious. But his most serious accident would happen once he was an adult. When Bobby Joe was still a preteen and they were living in Miami, his mother married another man who briefly became a father figure to the boy. He got him interested in learning the electrical trade. But Luella soon found out that her new husband was already married and quickly got an annulment. When Bobby Joe was around 16 or 17, Luella moved in with a man that he despised, and his attitude changed drastically. Bobby Joe had already quit school when he was 15 years old, though he was tested and found to have an IQ of 118, slightly above average. From 13 years old to 18 when he joined the Air Force, Bobby worked as an electrician's helper. Bobby Joe met Cynthia Cindy Jean Guthrie when they were both teenagers living in Miami. They were married January 25th, 1974, on the Air Force Base Bobby Joe was stationed at. Cindy said that in the beginning of their marriage, he was a great husband. They had a son and daughter soon after marrying, and Cindy said they were an average family for a while. But the stress of having a family started to affect Bobby Joe. When he was 20 years old and still married, Bobby Joe got into a motorcycle accident where he was thrown over a car, landed on his head, and suffered a major head injury. His helmet was cracked, and the top of his head was also badly road burned. He was unconscious for around 6 hours. He took amphetamines for around 9 months to a year following the accident. Bobby Joe received disability from the military for his brain damage and a severe ankle injury from the accident. His brain showed various abnormalities in the area of the amygdala. According to Cindy, Bobby Joe changed from a loving father and husband into an abusive and controlling man. She said he would explode about little things, or nothing at all. His mood swings were unpredictable, and he became violent. And while he was still in the hospital, he began to have insatiable sexual urges. Nurses complained that he masturbated 5 to 6 times a day and didn't seem to care if they were in the room. Cindy said that Bobby Joe's sexual appetite continued unabated when he came home. He insisted on having sex with her 3 or 4 times a day. He told Cindy what to do, what to eat, what to wear, and how to act. Cindy was young and impressionable, and she went along with her husband's controlling behavior until his violence escalated. They began fighting a lot, and Bobby Joe would smack Cindy in the face or in the back of her head. She said he always apologized, but things just kept getting worse. He had started choking or strangling her during arguments until she lost consciousness. She reported that this happened 2 to 3 times. But the altercation that finally ended their marriage was in 1982. They were fighting, and Bobby Joe grabbed her by the throat and then bashed her head into the corner of their TV set. She lost consciousness, and when she awoke, she drove herself to the ER to get stitches. When she got home from the ER, Bobby Joe was sleeping. Cindy told True Crime Daily that she loaded a shotgun and put the barrel against Bobby Joe's head. She said she tried to pull the trigger but couldn't bring herself to do it. Instead, she packed up her children and left, filing for divorce. Years later, when her ex-husband was arrested and tried as a serial killer, Cindy went through very dark times. She told True Crime Daily that if she had shot him, 10 women would still be alive. But Cindy was able to move on with her life. She remarried and became a domestic violence victims advocate. And while her marriage had ended in violence, she was later supportive of her ex-husband and always insisted that he had been a good father. By the time they divorced, Bobby Joe was working as an X-ray technician, though he had trouble keeping jobs. Later, many female colleagues testified to his inappropriate language, bordering on sexual harassment. He even made male co-workers uncomfortable with his explicit descriptions of sex and his habit of keeping pornographic photos around his work area and in his locker. He was just a creep. There was nothing really to report to police, at least not during that era. So Bobby Joe just kept finding new jobs, with no stains on his resume following him around. Little did friends and co-workers know, but Bobby Joe Long was an extremely violent man who had successfully avoided detection for years as a serial rapist. I'm going to pause now to hear a word from one of our sponsors. Orate is fine jewelry made in New York City. It's a company founded by women for women, and prices range from classic to statement to completely original pieces. Orate's gold feels substantial, and their diamonds sparkle brilliantly. And because it's all real gold, you can wear it to sleep, cook, shower, or do anything really. I've got the solid circle ring, and I adore it. It's so unique and beautiful, and I rarely take it off. All Orate pieces come with a lifetime warranty because they are confident their jewelry lasts. The company was started by 2 friends during brunch when one was complaining about how she got a green finger from an overpriced ring, sparking a conversation about how fed up they were with the jewelry market. Because Orate sells direct to you with no middleman, they can offer the same quality as traditional Fifth Avenue brands at a fraction of the cost. Orate has hacked the jewelry market, making real gold accessible for real women. You get gorgeous designs with amazing quality at actual affordable prices. For 15% off your first Orate purchase, go to oratenewyork.com/southernfried and use the promo code southernfried. That's AURATENewYork.com/southernfried. And don't forget to enter the promo code southernfried to get 15% off your first beautiful Orate piece. Based on later confessions, it is estimated that Bobby Joe Long committed upwards of 50 rapes and robberies in a 2-year period. He used the classified ads to find his victims. He would show up as an interested buyer, gain access to their house, then rape and rob the victim. Many women did not come forward, and it wasn't until years later that some of his victims spoke out, often in online forums. But Bobby Joe said he had gotten away with rapes from California, West Virginia, Kentucky, and then all over Florida, including Tampa, Miami, and Fort Lauderdale. But some women did come forward once he was finally caught as the Tampa Bay serial killer. The first body found was not actually Bobby Joe's first victim, but the horrific display of her body would become his calling card. On May 13, 1984, on Mother's Day, some young boys were in a remote area of Southern Hillsborough County near an interstate when they found a dead body. When police arrived at the scene, they saw the naked body of a woman lying face down with her hands tied behind her back. She was tied with a rope with a leash-like extension that was also tied around her neck. And her legs were spread apart approximately 5 feet. This is the gruesome display that would haunt investigators for the rest of their lives. I've unfortunately seen a crime scene photo, and the only thing I can think to compare it to is the Black Dahlia. It's shocking, horrific, and intentionally sexually degrading. No clothing or belongings were found near her body, but she was identified by her fingerprints as a 20-year-old exotic dancer who worked the red light district on Dale Mabry Boulevard. She was tiny, only 5'2" tall, weighing 88 pounds. Nu Yen Long was born on November 1, 1964 in Laos. She moved from California to Florida 6 months prior to her death. Nu Yen went by the street names Lana and Peggy. She worked as a stripper at the Tampa club, the Sly Fox, and was known to use drugs and alcohol. She was last seen in her apartment complex 3 days before she was found dead. Sadly, Nu Yen was making changes in her life before she crossed paths with Bobby Joe Long. She had enrolled in the University of South Florida to study art and cinema. Police thought she had been picked up as she walked back to her apartment near campus after work in the early morning hours of May 11th. An autopsy would find that she died from strangulation from the rope around her neck. Police noticed tire tracks leading from the roadway to the body. 3 of the tires were different brands and distinctive. The evidence found at the scene was sent to the FBI laboratory because the Hillsborough County Sheriff's Office did not have the experience to deal with such a murder. It is a credit to their department that they immediately recognized the signs of a sadistic sexual murder and knew it was beyond their expertise. Throughout the investigations and all the murders, Hillsborough would cooperate with 2 other counties, the city of Tampa, as well as the FBI. Red fibers were found at the scene, and the FBI lab determined that they most likely came from the interior carpet of a car. Today, fiber evidence is heavily scrutinized, but those little red fibers would be found at other crime scenes. Whether or not you believe fiber evidence is junk science, the similar fibers still tied many of the victims together circumstantially. The second body was found 2 weeks later. On May 27, 1984, at around 11:30 a.m., a woman's body was found in an isolated area of eastern Hillsborough County near Interstate 4. She was nude, and her clothes were near her body. She was on her back, and her hands were bound at her waist with rope. And she had a ligature around her neck with the same type of rope. There were rope burns on her neck and chin, but unlike Nu Yen, she had severe blunt force trauma to her head and several stab wounds to her neck. Her throat had been slashed so violently, she was nearly decapitated. The coroner estimated that she had been there for about 8 to 10 hours before she was discovered. Her name was Michelle Denise Sims, and she was also identified by fingerprints on file with the St. Lucie County Sheriff's Department. Born in May 1962, Michelle was a former beauty queen. But after moving to Florida and desperate, Michelle became a sex worker, frequenting Kennedy Boulevard in the Tampa Bay area. She was last seen on May 26, 1984, walking with 2 white men around Kennedy Boulevard, known as a red light district. Michelle was also a small girl, only 5'4" tall, weighing about 120 pounds. Hair and fibers were found at the scene and were taken into evidence. Tire tracks were also found, and all evidence was turned over to the FBI for analysis. The fibers on her body were similar to those found on Nu Yen's body, and the tire tracks were a match from Nu Yen's crime scene. However, Michelle's body was dumped, not posed. From the severity of her stab wounds to the way her body looked as though it had been dumped out of a car, the scene was different. It looked more like a rage killing rather than the careful posing of Nu Yen. Bobby Joe Long would later confirm this scenario. As Michelle was found in Hillsborough County, her identity wasn't known right away, and a composite sketch of her face was given to the media. A tip led the police to the St. Lucie County Sheriff's Department. Hillsborough police wasted no time warning the public that they had a predator working the Tampa Bay area. The red carpet fibers were enough to tie the murders, though that detail was specifically held back from the media. On June 24, 1984, another body was found. This time in an orange grove in southeastern Hillsborough County. The victim was fully clothed and in an advanced stage of decomposition. So much so that the weight of her body and her clothes was only 25 pounds. She was virtually mummified. The victim was identified through dental records as 22-year-old Elizabeth Loudenback. All of the evidence found at the scene was sent to the FBI, but was not initially asked to be compared to the other evidence from the first two crime scenes. That's because there was differences between this victim and the previous two found. Elizabeth didn't have ligatures, and her body was not found near an interstate. However, her cause of death was strangulation, and her body did appear to be posed. Elizabeth's boyfriend was taken in for questioning, and he failed a polygraph. He was considered to be a suspect until the familiar red fibers were found on Elizabeth's body. The fibers were compared to the fibers found on Nguyen and Michelle. They were considered a match. Elizabeth was the third known victim of the Tampa Bay area serial killer. Elizabeth Loudenback was born on January 10, 1962 in Indiana and grew up in Lincoln City. She had moved to Florida with her mother and two siblings 2 years before she was murdered. In life, she had also been a petite girl. Elizabeth worked as an assembly line worker at Astra Products. She was last seen at around 7 p.m. on June 8, 1984. Elizabeth was not a sex worker or an exotic dancer, but she was known to hang around the northern Hillsborough area of Nebraska Avenue, not far from the red light districts. As the hot summer months waned into fall, more bodies were found. The killer was escalating, but also, some victims found would be skeletal and determined to have been killed before the first victims were found earlier that summer. The next girl was found on October 7, 1984. She was black, nude, and posed face down, similar to other victims. She was found near the Pasco and Hillsborough County lines, lying near the entrance to a cattle ranch. Her clothes, except for her bra, were next to her body. The bra was tied onto the entrance gate. Her head was in an advanced state of decomposition, much more so than the remainder of her body. The autopsy showed a puncture wound to the back of her neck, but a gunshot wound to her head was the cause of death. This was new. All other victims so far had died from strangulation, except for the stabbing of Michelle Sims. The victim was found to be 18-year-old Chanel Devon Williams. She was Bobby Joe's only black victim, but she definitely fit his preferred type. She was a sex worker, vulnerable, and willing to get into strange cars. Chanel was born on March 26, 1966. She had been arrested just 2 weeks before her death for prostitution. She was last seen on the night of September 30, 1984, by another sex worker who was working with Chanel near the Nebraska Avenue area. Chanel's co-worker was picked up by a John and went to a motel less than a quarter mile from where they were working. Chanel was supposed to walk to the motel to check on her friend, but she never made it. At this point in the investigation, police asked the FBI to conduct a criminal personality profile on the killer based on Nguyen, Michelle, Elizabeth, and Chanel. The FBI's profile showed similarities between Nguyen and Michelle, but the lack of ligatures, as well as Chanel's race and cause of death, and because Elizabeth was found fully clothed, caused the profiler to believe that their murders were not linked. However, once lab testing from the crime scenes were back, Chanel and Elizabeth were linked. Once again, the red carpet fibers had been found. 1 week later, on October 14th, another body was found. This body was nude from the waist down and was discovered in an unpopulated area of northeastern Hillsborough County. The body appeared to have been dragged around 30 feet from the nearby dirt road into an orange grove, just like Elizabeth Loudenback. Her hands were bound in front of her body, and her right wrist and legs were bound together by another rope. Her throat had ligature marks, and she had been struck viciously on the forehead and then strangled to death. The woman was identified as 28-year-old Karen Beth Dinsfriend. Karen was also a sex worker, and so far the oldest of Bobby Joe's victims, though like the rest, she was petite and she looked much younger than she was. The same red fibers from the previous victims were found on Karen's body. The knots in the ligatures were also found to be similar to knots from other victims. Karen was born on September 3, 1955, in Framingham, Massachusetts. She was described as a beautiful, bright little girl who was loved by her family, but unfortunately had developed a cocaine habit. She was last seen working in the Nebraska and Hillsborough Avenue area in the early morning hours of October 14, 1984. She was identified through dental records. By now, all homicide detectives in the Hillsborough County Sheriff's Office were working these gruesome serial murders. Six tactical deputies patrolled the Nebraska Avenue and West Kennedy Boulevard areas of North Tampa at night, the areas where many of the victims worked. The police also warned the public again about the murders. Sex workers were not the only ones afraid. Women who worked in bars or liquor stores were also frightened. The Tampa Bay area held its collective breath, praying for an arrest. Ted Bundy, sitting on Florida's death row, even wrote to the investigators offering to help. He asked if they were watching the crime scenes, as the killer was probably returning to them. That was actually part of Bundy's MO, but Tampa investigators declined his offer of assistance. By now, Bundy was known to do or claim anything to delay his own execution. And then 2 weeks later, another body was found. On the day before Halloween, Kimberly Kyle Hopps was found near Highway 301 in northern Hillsborough County, just north of the Pasco County line. Her body was nude and mummified, but she was posed in the same gruesome and degrading manner as Nguyen, Elizabeth, and Chanel. Kimberly was born on September 24, 1962, in Toledo, Ohio. Due to the state of her body, she was not identified until Bobby Joe Long was finally arrested. Just a week after Kimberly's mummified remains were found, on November 6th, another woman's body was found in a horse pasture in Pasco County, just north of the Hillsborough County line, by two women on horseback. There was nothing left but skeletal remains this time, but a ligature was still found around one of her hand bones and to her throat. Her bones were scattered about by animals, and later, one of the women who found her remembered that her dogs had been sick almost 2 weeks before and had to have their stomachs pumped. The veterinarian had found chunks of meat of unknown origin. That grisly development made sense when the autopsy showed that this woman had only been dead for around 10 to 20 days. Some clothing and hair was found near her body. When the Hillsborough County Sheriff's Office heard about there being a ligature on the body of the Pasco County homicide, the Hillsborough office met with the Pasco office. While working together to determine who the victim was, the two agencies were able to identify the remains as those of 18-year-old Virginia Lee Johnson. Virginia was born on February 7, 1966. She was from Connecticut. She split her time between Connecticut and Tampa. Virginia was a sex worker in the North Nebraska Avenue area. She had been reported as missing on November 18th by a friend of hers. She had last been seen on October 15th, 1984. After Virginia was reported missing, her parents were contacted, and Virginia was identified through dental records. The evidence found at the scene was sent to the FBI. Although there was barely any evidence to collect, there was a red carpet fiber in Virginia's hair. Just 6 days after Virginia was found, Kim Marie Swan was found on November 12th. She was last seen walking out of a convenience store near her parents' house at around 3 p.m. on November 11th, 1984. She was found on an incline off of North Orient Road in the city of Tampa, out of the jurisdiction of Hillsborough and Pasco counties. Her body was found face down and looked as if it had been dumped over the guardrail to the Orient Road overpass. Kim was born on May 17, 1963, in Goldsboro, North Carolina. At the time of her death, Kim had lived in Tampa for 18 years. Right before her murder, Kim enrolled in vocational school to become a medical technician. She had a son named Robert. She worked as an exotic dancer and was also a known drug user. However, she had been recently treated for gonorrhea at a local clinic, so it's believed Kim may have also been a sex worker. Kim had lain there for less than 24 hours when she was discovered. Her jeans and shirt were found near her body, and tire tracks were also found nearby. Police thought the killer pulled off the road and then threw her body over the edge, onto the incline. Fecal matter was found on the inside of her legs and on her clothing. There was ligature marks on her neck, both wrists, and arms. But no ligature ropes were found at the scene. Despite the fact that it looked as though Kim was dumped quickly, she was still posed in that same horrifically degrading manner as the other victims had been. The Tampa police called the Hillsborough police because of the ligature marks. The evidence from the scene was sent to the FBI. The tire tracks found had similarities to the tracks found from New Inn's and Michelle's crime scenes. Red carpet fibers were found on Kim's clothing. Two more bodies were found, but just days after the arrest of Bobby Joe Long. The kidnapping and rape of Lisa McVeigh happened on November 3rd, within days of the last three bodies that were found. Finally, law enforcement had something to go on. Lisa McVeigh would be Bobby Joe Long's undoing. I'm going to pause now for a final word from our sponsors. I am always on my phone. As a podcaster, I'm tied to social media 24/7, and I travel a lot. The thought of dropping and breaking my phone and putting me out of commission makes my stomach hurt. That's why I've always used bulky impact cases, and those aren't cute. Since I'm so tied to my phone, I would like the case to be stylish. That's why I was so excited to get my new phone case from Casetify. Casetify doesn't make you sacrifice style to keep your phone safe. With military-grade drop protection and super cute designs, you get the best of both worlds. No more bulky phone cases. Casetify cases are as sleek as they are stylish, and they have thousands of designs to choose from. Casetify collaborates with many name brands and artists. They have Pokemon and Wonder Woman collections, and also Sarah Jessica Parker and the Rolling Stones have worked with them. And you can create your own custom cases with your favorite colors and text. And they do really protect your phone. Casetify cases will protect your phone from drops of more than 6 feet. With that security and style, you can show off your new phone case on Insta and feel like a celebrity influencer. Try it today. Go to casetify.com/southernfried to get 20% off your new phone case. That's casetify.com/southernfried for 20% off your Casetify purchase. I've suffered from debilitating migraines since I was in my early 20s. I know how awful it is to lose whole days to that pain. And sitting in an ER trying to patiently explain your symptoms to yet another doctor is so frustrating. Cove is making that part of migraines a little easier. You can find a treatment from the comfort of your own home, and then the medication is mailed right to your door. That's why I was so relieved to find Cove, and I'm so happy to tell you about it. Cove starts with a consultation by a licensed physician in your state who reviews your symptoms and determines the best course of treatment for you. I found navigating the website easy and yet also very informative. Understanding migraines, the causes, and symptoms is often the hardest part. Cove breaks down everything you need to know about your migraines and about migraine treatments. Migraines are personal, therefore each treatment plan is too. And no medical insurance is necessary. Sign up for Cove and receive your first month of medication free. Southern Fried listeners, I have a special link for you to get your first month of treatment for free for a limited time. Go to withcove.com/southernfried. That's withcove.com/southernfried. Get started today before the next migraine hits. Go to withcove.com/southernfried. At this point in the investigation, the Hillsborough, Pasco, and Tampa police all relate information to each other, including the abduction and rape of Lisa McVeigh, which was under the jurisdiction of the Tampa City Police. The Tampa Police also sent the evidence from Lisa McVeigh to the FBI. The evidence from her clothes showed the same red fibers found on the other victims. A task force was then put together with members from Hillsborough, Tampa, Pasco, the FBI, and the Florida Department of Law Enforcement. They talked with Lisa McVeigh, and she again told them everything she knew. They were especially interested in her description of her attacker's car as a maroon Dodge Magnum and that he had stopped at an ATM. Teams of officers split up to patrol the areas where the bodies had been found. On November 15th, one team of patrol cars passed a red Dodge Magnum driving down Nebraska Avenue in North Tampa. The team pulled over the Magnum and told the driver they were looking for a robbery suspect. The driver, Robert Joseph Long, was photographed and a field interrogation report was written. But he was not yet arrested. Within 2 hours, he was put under 24-hour surveillance. Now that they had a name, investigators checked the records for all ATMs in the North Tampa area where Lisa had been released. Bobby Joe had used a 24-hour ATM near his apartment at 3 a.m. on the morning Lisa was let go. She was shown a lineup of photographs and immediately picked Bobby Joe out of the lineup. After Lisa identified her abductor as Bobby Joe Long, police got a search and arrest warrant for her abduction, kidnapping, and sexual battery. Once they had their warrants, police called the Behavioral Science Unit at the FBI Academy to ask how they should interview Bobby Joe. The BSU agent headed to Tampa, as well as a special agent who had helped to compare fibers from Bobby Joe's apartment and vehicle, and to be able to help in any other crime scene searches. When they were ready to arrest Bobby Joe Long on November 16th, he was in a movie theater. He was arrested as he walked out to his car. It had only been 36 hours since the task force was created. The police took Bobby Joe back to his apartment so he could be there while they searched his property, protocol for Hillsborough County. But Bobby Joe declined to remain on scene as his apartment was searched, so he was taken straight to interrogation at the Hillsborough County Sheriff's Office. He was given a Miranda waiver and signed it. The FBI agent, who had put together the criminal personality profile on Bobby Joe, told police that he would most likely cooperate if the officers displayed both their authority and a thorough knowledge of the case. The interrogating officers took the FBI agent's advice. They started the interview by asking Bobby Joe exactly how he had abducted Lisa McVeigh, not if he had. He confessed immediately, describing how he had seen her riding her bicycle, drove past her, and then waited in the shadows to snatch her off of her bike. Incredibly, Bobby Joe told the detectives, quote, "She was a real nice kid. I wish I hadn't done what I did to her." After his full confession, the detectives asked if he knew about physical evidence, like hair and blood. Bobby Joe almost rolled his eyes as he said, yeah. And then they said, what about fiber and tire impressions? And Bobby Joe's face tightened. Another officer casually walked in the room and handed over a file of photos of all the murder victims to the interrogating officers. One asked Bobby Joe if he had ever picked up any prostitutes, and Bobby said, I'd rather not answer that. So then they showed him the crime scene photographs from the file, and Bobby Joe said, quote, "The complexion of things have sure changed since you came into the room. I think I might need an attorney." One of the officers said, "Nothing has changed, Bobby. We're not here to ask you if you did this. We know you did this. We just want to know why." Even though Bobby Joe Long had signed a Miranda waiver, this would turn out to be a devastating mistake on the part of the police. At the time, it worked. Bobby Joe Long sat there and confessed to 10 murders and multiple rapes. During the interrogation, the FBI had sent back over the results from the tire impressions. They were an exact match for the 3 different tires on Bobby Joe's car. The more evidence they showed him, the more he loosened up, eventually saying simply, quote, "Yeah, I killed them, all the ones in the paper. I did them all." Bobby Joe Long then gave descriptions of each rape and murder. He started with New Inn, explaining how he offered her a ride as she was walking home, and she accepted. When he asked her if she wanted to go for a drink, she declined, and he pulled a knife on her. He tied her up, raped her, strangled her, and then posed her body. He did not explain the significance of the pose, but later, after they interviewed male colleagues, they found that Bobby Joe had an obsession with anal sex. He often made crude remarks about women he saw and always said something along the lines of, quote, "I'd like to stick it up her ass." As for Michelle Sims, the second victim found, who had been viciously stabbed and dumped, but not posed, Bobby Joe explained it was because she fought back so hard. He became enraged and he dumped her out the passenger side of his car while she was still bleeding and drove off. He gave another horrific detail explaining the fecal matter found on Kim Swan's legs and clothing. After he had raped her and was strangling her, Kim's bowels released, either in her terror or as she was dying. Disgusted, this is why Bobby Joe threw her body over the guard railing at the overpass, leaving her basically in plain sight instead of finding a remote dump site. Though he did still take the time to stop and degrade her one final time in death in that horrific pose. Bobby Joe also helped identify Kimberly Kyle Hopps. He said he knew her by her street name, Sugar. With that information, police quickly found that Kimberly Kyle Hopps had been reported missing by her boyfriend, who had seen her getting into a maroon car. Her hair would later be found in Bobby Joe Long's vehicle. Bobby Joe even drew a map leading police to yet another victim, a young woman who had gone missing from the city of Tampa named Vicki Elliott. Vicki Marie Elliott was born on July 12, 1963 in Michigan. She was not a sex worker. She was a student who was known to be a responsible and hard worker. She and her brother had moved to the Tampa Bay area after high school, where they had relatives. Vicki had been working in a Ramada Inn coffee shop, and when she didn't show up on September 6th, her boss reported her missing. Bobby Joe explained that he pulled up next to her car late on the night of September 5th. He had seen her swerving and asked her if she was drunk. She was laughing and told him yes, and accepted a sober ride from him when he offered. He raped and strangled her like he had all the others. She pitifully tried to defend herself with a pair of scissors she had in her purse. Her body was found the day after his arrest on November 16th, exactly where the map had shown. He had shoved the scissors into her vagina because he was so enraged that she fought back. After giving officers a map to Vicky's body, Bobby Joe Long confessed to his first actual murder victim. Her name was Artis Wick. She went by the name of Anne and was born in May of 1963. She was killed in March 1984, but Bobby Joe didn't give much detail about her murder. A couple out walking on November 22nd stumbled upon her skull, and investigators soon found most of the rest of her bones scattered in the area. She was identified through dental records. In all, Bobby Joe Long confessed to 10 homicides in the Tampa Bay area over a period of 8 months. All of his victims were small women and were between the ages of 18 and 28 years old. Most of them were sex workers, but they were all vulnerable from drugs or alcohol or for being in the wrong place at the wrong time. I do want to point out that there was semen evidence found on several victims, the ones whose bodies were not in such an advanced state of decomposition. But DNA profiling was still in its infancy and would not be used in a criminal case until 1986. And while investigators did have matching blood types, because so many of his victims were sex workers, that evidence could be easily refuted as semen left by a John rather than Bobby Joe Long. So the blood evidence was not a major factor in his criminal proceedings. Besides, a full confession would trump blood testing in court any day. At the end of his long interview with police, Bobby Joe Long made the sinister comment, quote, "You guys know that the only reason you caught me is that I let Lisa go. I'm sorry for what I did, but you know what? Letting Lisa go makes it worth killing all the others." Bobby Joe's strange fixation on the 17-year-old girl had been his downfall. She was the only victim he brought back to his apartment, although she wasn't the only girl he let go. The detectives asked Bobby Joe if he knew anything about a rape and robbery in Newport Richey. Bobby Joe Long did not hesitate to open the floodgates on his many rape victims. He admitted he was the man known as the classified ads rapist. He would look through the want ads and find people either selling their home or some appliance. He would call first to make sure it was a woman, and then ask when her husband would be home to help him load his truck if he planned to buy what she was selling. He then knew the exact address and how long the woman would be alone. He attacked the woman in Newport Richey after simply walking up to her door and saying he saw an ad that she was selling her house. After she agreed to let him in and look around, he pulled a gun on her, tied her up, raped her, and then robbed the home. Right before his first murder trial on April 17, 1985, Bobby was convicted of kidnapping, robbery, and sexual battery for the Newport Richey attack. On June 17th, he was sentenced to 99 years for each charge. He was also tied to a woman in Palm Harbor who was selling furniture. He got into the house and also tied her up and raped her before robbing the home. Bobby Joe pled guilty to kidnapping, robbery, and sexual battery for this case on July 12, 1985. He was sentenced to life in prison for each charge. And he confessed to the abduction of a woman from a Carrollwood parking lot in April of 1984. He pled to aggravated assault and got 3 years probation for that case. In all, he told investigators he guessed he had raped 40 to 50 women in at least four different states. But the classified ad rapes had mostly been in Florida. Bobby Joe Long's first trial was for the murder of Virginia Johnson. It was held in Dade City, Florida, in Pasco County. Virginia's case was tried first because she was the only victim from Pasco County, and law enforcement hoped to combine the Hillsborough murders. The trial began on April 22, 1985, and lasted for a week. The prosecution presented evidence of Virginia's hair found in Bobby Joe's car, the red carpet fiber found on her body that matched his vehicle, and of course, most importantly, they had Bobby Joe's confession. His defense was centered around the testimony of a psychiatrist who said that Bobby Joe suffered from an atypical psychosis, which made it impossible for him to kill with calculated premeditation. He was found guilty on April 27, 1985, and was sentenced to death unanimously by the jury. The jury later said that they barely considered the prospect that Bobby Joe was mentally ill. One juror commented to the press, quote, "He knows exactly what he does and why he does it." By early September, Hillsborough County prosecutors were preparing for eight trials for victims in their county. The first Hillsborough County trial was going to be for the murder of Michelle Sims. Michelle's case was chosen first due to the brutality of her murder, as well as that case had the strongest forensic evidence. This was Bobby Joe's worst rage killing, and he had been sloppy. But before the trial could get started, Bobby Joe entered a plea agreement for all Hillsborough County charges. The prosecution and the defense agreed on a plea agreement for eight counts of first-degree murder, eight counts of kidnapping, and seven counts of sexual battery, as well as the kidnapping and sexual battery of Lisa McVeigh. Bobby Joe Long pled guilty to all charges on September 23, 1985. And on the same day, for every count, with the exception of the charges for Michelle Sims, Bobby Joe Long was given a life sentence. As part of the agreement, the state was allowed to seek the death penalty for the murder of Michelle Sims, and Bobby Joe was not allowed to contest the admissibility of any statements he had given to police. On July 10, 1986, the penalty phase for the Michelle Sims murder was held in Tampa. The prosecution presented Long's confession of killing Michelle Sims and Virginia Johnson. A state expert testified that Bobby Joe Long was not under the influence of any extreme mental disturbance and that he indeed had the capacity to understand what he was doing. He did not meet the requirements of law for being substantially impaired enough to be not responsible. The defense had four professional experts at trial who all testified to the opposite. They contended that Bobby Joe Long suffered from extreme mental and emotional disturbance and was unable to appreciate the criminality of his conduct. The reasons cited by these experts were Bobby Joe's troubled family life and the numerous head injuries he had suffered, which led to brain damage and severe mental problems. After 1 week of testimony for the penalty phase for Michelle Sims' rape and murder, the jury voted 11-1 for the death penalty. But in a November 1987 decision, Bobby Joe's conviction and death sentence for the murder of Virginia Johnson was vacated and a new trial was ordered. Bobby Joe's defense brought up 10 challenges in his appeal, but the Supreme Court of Florida only focused on one, his Miranda rights. Remember, during his original interrogation following his arrest, Bobby Joe confessed to the abduction and rape of Lisa McVeigh. But when the interrogators asked about the murder victims, Bobby Joe had said that he, quote, might need an attorney. Because Bobby Joe had signed a Miranda waiver, the detectives chose to ignore this comment and kept interrogating him. Because of this, his confession regarding the murder of Virginia Johnson was not voluntary and was deemed inadmissible. In a June 30, 1988 decision, the Supreme Court of Florida ordered a new proceeding regarding the death sentence for Michelle Sims' murder. The Supreme Court of Florida found that the Hillsborough guilty pleas were valid, and so were the life sentences. But the court found that the Pasco County conviction, Virginia Johnson's murder, used as an aggravating circumstance in the penalty phase proceeding, was an error. So Bobby Joe should get a new death sentence proceeding. During his second trial for the murder of Virginia Johnson in 1988, the prosecution again entered evidence about the kidnapping and rape of Lisa McVeigh, as well as Bobby Joe's other murders. And this time, they had an interview that Bobby Joe gave to CBS with damning statements. In an interview given from prison, Bobby Joe explained his MO, saying, quote, "When I saw them walking down the street, it was like ABCD. I pull over, they get in, I drive a little ways, stop, pull a knife, a gun, whatever, tie them up, and take them out. And that would be it. And they all went exactly the same until McVeigh came along." He came across as cold and calculating and showed absolutely no remorse for his crimes. Bobby Joe was found guilty, and the jury voted 9-3 that he would get the death penalty. But Bobby Joe Long's conviction and sentence were once again vacated, and a new trial was ordered by the Supreme Court of Florida. The Supreme Court found that the judge should not have allowed the CBS video to be played because they only showed an edited portion, and the prosecution should not have discussed any of the other murders. For the third trial, the Supreme Court had ruled that the CBS interview could be entered into evidence as long as the whole segment was shown to the jury. However, no evidence of Bobby Joe's guilty pleas in Hillsborough County could be used in court, and Lisa McVeigh could only testify in order to identify Bobby Joe Long. The horrific details of her 26-hour ordeal would not be admissible. Losing the admissibility of what had happened to Lisa and the guilty pleas in Hillsborough County were huge blows to the prosecution. However, in the end, it didn't matter. Bobby Joe was again found guilty for the rape and murder of Virginia Johnson, and on March 18, 1994, he was sentenced to death, this time with a 7-5 vote. Unfortunately, this conviction and sentence was overturned yet again because the case was, quote, tainted by the mention of the Hillsborough cases. In the new fourth trial for the rape and murder of Virginia Johnson, the prosecution introduced evidence of Bobby Joe's two prior rape convictions. The defense again called a psychologist to support their position that Bobby Joe was not guilty by reason of mental defect. The psychologist testified that he was severely mentally ill, diagnosed as bipolar, and had temporal lobe epilepsy caused by his many head injuries. The psychologist said that because of these illnesses, Bobby Joe suffered from sexual sadism. Another forensic psychologist diagnosed Bobby Joe with paraphilia and antisocial personality disorder. Because of his illnesses and brain injuries, the defense asked for a life sentence instead of a death sentence. But Bobby Joe Long was once again found guilty and sentenced to death unanimously by this jury. I find this really interesting, considering that in this trial, Bobby Joe's defense used better expert witnesses and more specific diagnoses for their client. The two prior juries had ruled for a death sentence, but they were split. And the prosecution had lost major points when they could not enter his previous guilty pleas in Hillsborough or any of the details about the kidnapping and rape of Lisa McVeigh. But I believe at this point, the public at large knew exactly what Bobby Joe Long was. Kneecapping the prosecution in a fourth trial did not change the minds of jurors who, whether they admitted it or not, would have been exposed to extensive publicity in this case. And during his time on death row, many of Bobby Joe's letters to other inmates were confiscated. Those letters showed his violent obsession with women he deemed as sluts and whores. He showed no remorse for raping and killing women he considered to be less than human because of their lifestyle. The only girl he ever expressed remorse over was Lisa McVeigh. He often called her a good girl and said he didn't know why he chose her. And he always said he did not regret letting her go. In an October 15, 1994 decision, the Supreme Court of Florida affirmed Bobby Joe Long's death sentence and his guilty pleas. In an interview with the media, Bobby Joe later said, quote, "I'm not proud of anything I've done, and the worst thing is, I don't understand why." After years of appeals and legal wranglings, Bobby Joe Long was finally scheduled to be executed on May 23, 2019. His attorneys tried for a last-minute stay of execution, arguing that lethal injection would be cruel and unusual due to Bobby Joe's history of epilepsy. They argued he would suffer a seizure instead of dying quickly. But the U.S. Supreme Court denied their argument, saying that Bobby Joe's history of epilepsy was well known for the last 30 years. They had all that time to argue their case. It was now too late. On May 23, 2019, at 6:55 p.m., 65-year-old Bobby Joe Long was executed by lethal injection at the Florida State Prison in Rayford. He had no last words. Lisa McVeigh and several family members of Bobby Joe's other victims attended the execution. By the time Bobby Joe was put to death, Lisa McVeigh had pursued a career in law enforcement. Today, she is a sheriff's deputy with Hillsborough County, working with the department who finally caught the man who brutally raped her and terrorized the Tampa Bay area for 2 years. Bobby Joe Long's execution this past May was controversial because of his extensive head injuries. In recent years, many studies have shown that a head injury in childhood is common to well-known serial killers like Richard Ramirez, David Berkowitz, John Wayne Gacy, Albert Fish, and numerous other killers, especially the sexual sadists. Ted Bundy supposedly had a childhood injury, but an autopsy did not find any evidence of trauma to his brain. Recent studies have shown that serial killers have lower activity in the prefrontal area of the brain. That's the area that controls aggression and regulates impulse control. Psychopaths also often have a shrunken amygdala, like Bobby Joe Long did, the part of the brain that controls emotion, explaining their lack of empathy and remorse. But traditionally, the American court system has refused to see psychopathy and other behavioral disorders as valid excuses for the legal definition of mental insanity. Our definition holds that a killer truly suffering from mental illness cannot determine the difference between right and wrong. The definition also explains that these types of killers are subject to uncontrollable impulsive behavior. For organized serial killers like Bobby Joe Long, Ted Bundy, and many other sexual sadists, our legal definition simply does not apply. Though they claim their behavior is an uncontrollable impulse, the amount of planning and premeditation proves otherwise. Their victims are prey, and they often enjoy the hunt as much as the kill. Bobby Joe Long enjoyed terrorizing his victims, and he carefully chose women he felt society didn't care about. And killing them was not enough to satisfy his needs. His horrific posing of many victims was his final degradation of their humanity. Southern Fried True Crime is written and produced by me, Erica Kelly. The original graphic art is by Coley Horner, and Southern Fried's original music is by Rob Harrison of Gamma Radio. A very special thanks to Haley Gray for her research assistance on this case. This was a difficult case to write and horrific to read about, so I really appreciate her support. For further reading, I recommend Deadly Deception by J.T. Hunter, but I warn you, he published almost all of the crime scene photos in that book. I will be in Charleston, South Carolina on October 26th, for the second annual Southern Podcast Meetup. It will be held at Tommy Condon's restaurant from 2 p.m. to 5 p.m. Come out, have a drink, and hang out with me and some of your favorite Southern podcasters, like Stephen from Trace Evidence, Mike Brown from Pleasing Terrors, Olivia Lynn from Flat Rock, Javier from Pretend Radio, Michael from Unresolved, Melissa from Moms and Murder, and our favorite carpetbagger, Nina from Already Gone. I hope some of you can join us. This is my last travel engagement of 2019. Also, I have a YouTube channel up and going. My good friend Stephanie Janelle has taken over this task and is doing an incredible job of finding photographs for all of the cases. The episodes she has uploaded look more like documentaries than the simple audio uploads I had done. I would love for you to check them out, and Stephanie has my whole catalog of episodes that she's working on, so subscribe if you like what you see. There is much more coming. If you enjoyed today's show, don't forget to subscribe, and please tell a friend or rate and review on iTunes. I'm also on most large platforms like Stitcher and Spotify. If you're interested in supporting the show, please visit my website, southernfriedtruecrime.com. There you can sign up to be a patron of the show, make a one-time donation, or purchase show merchandise. That's southernfriedtruecrime.com. If you have any case suggestions, please email southernfriedtruecrime@gmail.com. Private messages on social media get lost, so email is best, and please feel free to reach out. I love hearing from you guys. Until next time, thanks so much for listening. Y'all take care.